So the next speaker is Brad Murray, and he's also the William Morris Davis speaker. So we have this lecture series that we try to do every year, and it's done in different universities in the in New England. And we invite a prominent geomorphologist to honor the legacy of Davis, who was professor at Harvard. So this year we invited Brad Murray. Brad Murray is a very good friend of mine, and is also working in the same area that I work, which is coastal geomorphology. But Brad is also a very creative scientist, spanning a lot of different fields. And one of these fields is part of like a philosophy or a complex systems, and this is why it's part of this conference. And also this idea of that simple models can capture a lot of reality and a lot of what we see on the Earth's surface. So I'm very glad to have you here. And we also want to give you this present for the Davis they totally look entrenched to me.
Thank you very much
for coming.
Thank you Sergio and Alicia. Very happy to be here. This is going to have a lot of resonance with Julie and Bill's talk, so I'm going to be talking about approaches to most primarily numerical modeling, but most of these points apply to analytical and conceptual models as well. We could subtitle this, or alternatively title it, what are the best building blocks models upon, or why do we like some models even though they're all completely wrong? And thank you for very influential conversations with a bunch of people, and actually the work that I'm going to be using as a example for many of the things I'll talk about initially and through the years in collaboration with Andrew Ashton, who couldn't be here today, who's at Woods Hole. I'm going to be using coastline dynamics as my main example as we go along here. So this is a space shuttle picture of the Carolina Capes, and they're located on that part of the world. And I'll also here and there talk about the gorgeous coastal features that you've got in this neighborhood. So to start with, there's two different senses of multi-scale systems in Earth science, at least it seems that way to me. And one is the common self-similar case, where situation we often think about, at least, where we've got basically the same phenomena happen across a wide range of scales. So if you zoom in across scales, you see essentially the same thing. There are interactions between the scales, but those interactions are the same between each level in the hierarchy. And so if you're going to construct a model of this sort of system, and as Bill showed us, there's a lot of examples in Earth science, and he showed us the landscape evolution example. In some senses, it makes great sense to start by representing processes as small as scale, as small as possible, explicitly in your models, so that you can capture the widest range of this dance of interactions between the scales. And on the other hand, here I'm going to focus more on a very different sense of multi-scale system, where we've got very different things happening at different scales, across a wide range of scales, which would be fine, except that these different things tend to interact with each other. So even if you've got a clearly defined scale of a phenomenon that you're interested in, it's often just not clear what is the best scale to start with, what scale to base your model on, either explicitly to represent in a numerical model or even to think about conceptually. And here's how it starts with the coastline example, where all of the action ultimately starts at the scale of grain motions and wave motions. So these are sub-millimeter to centimeter spatial scales, and the time scale associated with wave motions is seconds, and all sorts of fascinating dynamics that tends to form ripples or mega ripples or various other kinds of bed forms, and very, very interesting in their own right, but these are important for larger scale phenomena because these bed forms act as bumps, as roughness elements. The bigger the roughness elements, the bigger the friction for larger scale sediment, for larger scale currents are, and they affect the amount of sediment that gets transported. The bigger the bumps, the more sediment is getting stirred up into the water. So if you're affecting both the amount of sediment in the water and the characteristics of the larger scale currents, you're going to affect morphology that develops on the larger space and time scales, such as the pattern of the longshore bars that we see here, the nearshore bars. This is a view taken just above Cape Hatteras on the Carolina coast. There's the Hatteras Lighthouse, for those of you that know this area. But the point here is that we've got where you see the waves breaking here, that's showing shallow water. So there's an longshore bar here, and where the waves are not breaking, that's showing a trough where the water's a bit deeper before you get to the shore. And gaps in the breaking indicate deeper areas that are channels, and called rip channels, and there's an associated rip current that's typically going offshore between these prominent bars. So there's a pattern of current and sediment transport and morphological evolution going on here that starts on the time scales of storms and goes up to sometimes weeks or months in between storms when these bars get formed and then evolve into a more and more complex shape. All of this potentially matters for the larger scales, because if you follow enough detail of the pattern of currents and sediment transport here, you would find over time that there's a net longshore transport. In this case, the long-term net transport is from north to south. This is looking at the same place, but now looking south. And that net transport that somehow comes about from all the complex dance of bars coming and going with storm cycles and evolving in really fascinating ways, that it's the long-term transfer of sediment from here to there that causes this whole feature to migrate over time. These capes tend to move. We've got something like a kilometer of erosion on this side of the cape in the last century or so, and something like a kilometer of accretion on that side. So this whole landform is moving. So if we are interested in this long-term migration of these shapes, or in how those shapes come about in the first place, or how those shapes might respond to changing climate forcing, so I'll talk about a little bit later, it's really not clear what scale is the best one to start at, either for explanation or prediction. That is not what I expected to happen there.
Supposed to run a model.
Mm-hmm.
So, what the next slide was going to say is just what scale do we start at? Our options go all the way down to the grain scale.
It's weird.
Actually, ideally, maybe we want to start by resolving the formation of those ripples, since they affect everything that happens at scales larger than that.
Maybe
we want to start at the barge, which is in practice what a lot of nearshore community, nearshore dynamics community does. There's plenty of fascinating phenomena that happen on this scale of storms and 100 years that are worth studying in your own right. Often there's an either explicit or implicit assumption that you have to understand the dynamics at that scale and get it right enough to then find the residual motions of sediment that lead to the long-term evolution of the system. And I think that's an important question. What scale is most appropriate one to start at? There is, in the earth science at least, I think, a strong tendency, a bias toward wanting to start at scales as small as possible. It feels more fundamental to us. And this way we can minimize the amount of parameterization that the subgrid scale dynamics that we have to just represent through some form of parameterization. We get as close as we can to fundamental physics, i.e. F equals ma. And when there's just fluid dynamics involved, we can do this. The smaller we go, the more of this turbulent dance we can resolve, and we can get closer to, if we ideally can get all the way down to the scale of the smallest turbulent eddies. Now, there's still parameterization because we still have to parameterize the molecular viscosity. We're not going to go down to molecular scales. Nobody really wants to do that, but we can. It's all treating F equals MA down to the almost to the smallest scales. We can do that. It gets messier when we talk about sediment transport and morphological evolution. To start with, if we're talking about large-scale sediment transport, we typically want to represent the bulk sediment flux, QS, as some function of the forcing, such as the shear stress on the bed. That's just a function of the flow velocity or the vertical derivative of flow velocity and grain size. And you might think that if we measure this in enough controlled circumstances in the lab and in the field, we'd come up with the right relationship. It wouldn't be F equals MA, but it's resulting from F equals MA at the grain scale, right? However, turns out that doesn't work very well. The best we can do at devising these empirical or semi-empirical relationships, we find that they apply well under some conditions, but none of them apply under all of them. All the conditions, and that's because there are different emergent structures that occur as sediment moves along the bed that end up affecting how much sediment transport happens under given set of conditions. So in this case, these are windblown ripples. The very cool simulation by Duran, Claudon, and Andreotti recently, that the emergence of these ripples affects the patterns of fluid flow and affects the amount of sediment transport that's getting moved along there. So if this approach of trying to treat some bulk flow, bulk sediment transport relationship doesn't work too well, maybe we need to go smaller and start at the grain scale. Sounds certainly plausible. And that's what Andreotti and Claudon and Duran have done so nicely to analyze the modes, the actual phenomena involved in alien windblown sediment transport and these windblown ripples. But if we want to start at the grain scale for the purposes of simulating these bed forms for their effect on larger scale flow and sediment transport, we want to get that just right. We want the size of these ripples and their shapes to be as accurate as possible because they affect the larger scale patterns of flow and sediment transport. And if we get the ripples a little bit wrong, we get the flow and sediment transport at the next scale a little bit wrong, and then the pass up to the scale above that is wrong, and we're not, this isn't a good foundation for the larger, much larger scale model. So, maybe we just need to modeling spherical grains like that picture I just showed you is great for that small range of scales to understand how those wind-generated ripples come about. But these same people, or a couple of them, have recently shown, and everybody kind of knows this, that the shape of the grain really can make a difference. And it can affect what you're predicting for these bed forms. It can affect the outcomes by orders of magnitude sometimes if you're under some conditions. So, okay, maybe we just need to start treating the grain shapes explicitly, and rather than spherical grains bouncing onto each other, we need to keep track of their rotational and translational motions, and when they interact with each other, then we find which parts of these asperities are going to rub up against each other, calculate the normal and tangential stresses, use a friction coefficient to figure out how they're going to trade their rotational and kinetic energies between each other, and maybe that will all work. Well, for one thing, treating realistic grain shapes is going to be hard, but for another, in the direction we're going here, we're moving away from fundamental physics. If you think of F equals MA as fundamental physics, once we're treating a frictional coefficient here, that's a parameterization of the interaction of much of microscale asperities. And now we're getting down to the molecular level. Really, to do that right, we want to treat quantum mechanics in some way. And that's an excuse for a digression for a few slides here into fundamental physics, if F equals ma is fundamental physics, and modern physics. Not news to any of you, I'm sure, but some of the things that we presuppose when we think of F equals ma as being fundamental don't jive with either quantum mechanics, where uncertainty tells us we can't have an object with a well-defined position and velocity at the same time. And in fact, there aren't any objects out there when you really try to interpret quantum mechanics. It's the best we can do is that there's these wave functions representing the probability density for there to be an object, if there were to be an object, but there aren't really any objects. Certainly not in the sense we're usually used to thinking about objects. So forget the solid matter, but there just doesn't seem to be objects as we usually think about it. Of course, we also think about length scales and time scales as being well-defined. Relativity shows that they're not. We think of conservation of momentum and mass as the bedrock of a good fundamentally sound model, but you know, conservation of mass doesn't apply in relativistic terms. I'm not saying this is a practical problem, because we're plainly not talking about relativistic realms or quantum mechanical sizes here. And I'm not saying that modern physics, that quantum or relativity, tell us the true nature of whatever's out there. I think we can all agree something's out there. Quantum mechanics is just too hard to interpret to think that it tells us the nature of reality in a fundamental way. What it does tell us, I think, really clearly, is about the nature of our experience of the universe. That what we think of as the laws of reality aren't fundamental properties of whatever it is that's out there. They're things that we've come up with evolutionarily and culturally. They're our own creations. And that's not a bad thing. That's a super, super useful and good thing. If I'm standing downhill of this boulder and it starts to roll, the fact that I believe in my good gut, my guts, that that thing is a solid object to start with, and that it's got a well-defined position and velocity, and that its velocity is increasing, and it's moving toward me, that's a useful set of models to have. And it's not that I don't care if they don't correspond to the true nature of what's out there, whatever that is. Those are just really useful models. But I think thinking about things in this way, at least I find it fun to think about my relationship with the universe in these ways. But also, so if our laws of reality are not sort of fundamental features of the universe, it helps us to think about in our earth science models or in our models in science in general, none of them are fundamentally right, at least none of the ones in earth science, you know, quantum mechanics aside, that's not what we address in earth science. None of them are wrong, but a lot of them are very useful in various contexts. So now coming back to the coastline example with this sort of in mind, the question about what scale do we start at really becomes what's the most useful scale, not what's the most fundamental scale. So if we're talking about some question that involves just hydrodynamics, such as, let's say, how much storm surge is Hurricane Matthew going to cause, or did cause, on this section of North Carolina, this is Wrightsville Beach for anybody who knows the area, then, you know, starting as small as possible with the most sophisticated numerical models that we can do, this is a fine idea that allows us to be more quantitatively accurate about the height of the storm surge and even maybe its distribution among these houses if we can really model that turbulence to small scales. So that's definitely useful. If we're starting to talk about questions that involve the morphological evolution, sediment transport, now then it's less clear. So we might also be asking questions in this picture about how the shape of the coastline has changed over time. We can see here that at some time in the past, probably something like the 1970s when these houses were built, the coastline shape was curved. This line of vegetated dunes and the beach in front of it would have come out around here and curved back that way. And now the shape of the coastline has changed. It's straightened out, would have straightened straight through these houses. except for the sandbag seawall that's protecting the houses out here and the beach nourishment, the fact that they put a whole bunch of sand on there to keep undoing the erosion in that local area. So if we're talking about these sediment transport involved problems, we're back to what scale is the best to start with. And it gets even more obvious that going down to try to treat MA, F equals MA most directly, doesn't work in a lot of other Earth surface problems because biology tends to be intimately involved. We've got another example shown behind this barrier with the marsh here. Sergio does a whole lot of work on topics involving vegetation and sediment transport in marsh environments. And it's like almost every Earth landscape these days, since evolution has given us these very effective and, for a physicist, annoying plants that cover the landscape these recent couple hundred million years. You can't study the morphological evolution of the coastal wetland without looking at the vegetation effects. And you can't study how the vegetation evolves, how the distribution of vegetation evolves without looking at the morphology. You just can't get anywhere in the system unless you look at the two-way coupling between the ecological dynamics and the physical dynamics. And in those kinds of systems, it's more obvious that trying to get down to F equals MA, even if we're just talking about vegetation, doesn't seem productive to probably much of anybody. Animals have huge effects on various landscapes. Human animals can have huge effects. I'll maybe show you just a little bit later that in the coastline example, vegetation doesn't change coastline evolution very much, but humans sure can. Human decision-making can put a whole lot of resources into protecting one part of the coast. Turns out that can change the behavior of a coastline over much wider scales than we would have thought, many tens of kilometers. And so if there's a number of communities doing this, humans are affecting the coastline as much as the waves are. And, you know, it's human decision-making now that's entrenched and it's entangled in this system. And maybe we want to try to reduce that to neuron biochemical interactions, but that doesn't seem like the most effective level of modeling here, I don't think. So the alternative, and preaching to the choir, I think, in this audience, is to look at emergent behaviors and the scales of interaction that can arise from the collective behavior of many different degrees of freedom, as we've been hearing about already today. And my favorite, most obvious example is hydrodynamics. If we're going to model water waves, we don't start from molecular dynamics, or much less quantum mechanics. We start from the macroscopic emergent variables of pressure and density that allow us to calculate how the water parcels are being accelerated by the pressure gradients related to the surface water slopes. And we can explain and predict water waves nicely based on these emergent dynamics. And cognition is another fun example. One point here is this is how physics in practice is typically done. There are certainly cases where we go straight to the reductionism, but it's typically done without talking about it this way in various steps of treating emergent dynamics, emergent variables and their interactions. I think the bias toward direct reductionism that's been common in geomorphology since the advent of process geomorphology a handful of decades ago is to some extent misguided physics envy, that trying to go toward the smallest scales to get the most fundamental interactions just isn't the way that physics is typically done often. So back to the coastline example, how would we treat, what are the emergent interactions that we might treat for those largest scale problems that I talked about before? And this story starts with a longshore sediment transport that can be very complicated in detail if you look at a particular beach with an arrangement of bars and channels, but let's ignore all that for a while and see how far we can get. A longshore sediment transport happens because waves bring momentum into the surf zone where the waves break. That's, once the waves are broken, it's pretty intuitive that they've got momentum. When they hit you, they knock you backwards and leave their momentum in your body. If you're not there, their momentum gets mixed into the water column as they disappear, and that continual addition of momentum in the direction the waves are moving into the water column is a force. The rate of inputted momentum is a force. The alongshore component of that force generates an alongshore current that's typically too slow by itself to move any sediment, but the wave turbulence from wave breaking keeps a bunch of sediment suspended in the water typically, and that sediment then just gets carried right along with even a subtle current. So the key aspect for where we're going next is that the strength of this current, and therefore the rate of alongshore sediment transport, the alongshore sediment flux, is controlled by, or depends at least on, the flux toward shore of alongshore momentum. So, and now if we think about a simplifying situation where we consider the wave angle and height to be constant along shore, at least offshore waves. This is before waves start to refract and shoal across the near shore, but in between things get very complicated. If we just assume that the waves offshore are homogeneous along a shoreline, which they are at any one time typically, then the flux towards shore of longshore momentum depends on the coastline orientation. So in the picture, the way I've drawn it here, this part of the coastline, the wave momentum, the alongshore component of that momentum is smaller, because the relative angle between the waves and the coastline is smaller there. And over here, the alongshore momentum is greater. And so here we tend to get more alongshore sediment flux, smaller alongshore sediment flux. If we think about the net alongshore sediment transport that comes when you integrate the effects of waves coming from a bunch of different directions, the whole wave climate. But if we assume for the moment that the waves typically have are something like I've drawn here, then we can think about the fact that the net alongshore sediment transport, if it's different from here to here, that's going to cause the coastline to change. Imagine drawing an imaginary box here, a control volume. We've got more sediment going out of that box than coming in, and if that keeps happening in the long term, that's shoreline erosion. Conversely, anywhere along here, if you draw a control volume, you've got more sediment coming in than going out, the coastline is going to be accreting seaward. So we can re-encapsulate this into saying that convex seaward stretches of the coastline are going to be eroding, and concave sections are accreting, just by considering these fluxes of momentum as a function of shoreline shape. And then altogether, we've got that the shape of the shoreline determines the patterns of a longshore sediment flux, which determines the patterns of shoreline shape change. For those of you who know the term, it's just an especially large scale example of morphodynamics. And we can interpret the evolution of Cape Cod in these ways, that this convex curvature that's developed is causing a gradient in a longshore sediment flux that's causing erosion, and the sediment's piling up off of the edges, etc. We don't need to consider the complicated details of the transient bar and channel configurations that we'd see if we zoomed in on any particular day here. A second important large-scale interaction on a lot of coastlines has to do with wave shadows. So consider this example from the east coast of England, where we've got a rocky headland that sticks out and protects some of the coastline from the dominant wave direction. So if we were back way deep in this wave shadow and we started moving along the coast, we'd start to experience waves from something like the dominant direction on more and more days, until we were all the way out of the wave shadow. So there's going to be a tendency for there to be a gradient in the net alongshore sediment flux just from this wave shadow. Now, these two large-scale interactions interact with each other, because the erosion that you're going to tend to get from the wave shadow gradient is going to cause concavity to develop. As that concavity develops, there's going to be a tendency for gradients in longshore flux related to the curvature. The deeper that concavity gets, the stronger those curvature-driven effects become. At some point, they often reach a balance. That defines the shape of coastlines in a lot of places. The balance between the curvature-driven gradients and the wave shadow-driven gradients. This can be true, this balance between wave shadow gradients and curvature, even without rocky headlands poking out. These are just two examples. The Carolina Capes form headlands and cast wave shadows that help determine the curvatures of the bays in between. These are sedimentary dynamic features called flying spits that have similar wave shadowing effects. But then the question is, where do these, if these are sedimentary dynamic features, why did they evolve? Why did they come about? For that, I'm going to tell a little bit more of the story about wave momentum fluxes in the longshore transport. Consider a couple of different limiting cases. One is the wave crests are parallel to the overall coastline orientation. So in this case, there's no longshore momentum, and so there's zero longshore sediment flux. And this graph would be there, and as we gradually increase the angle from that limit, sediment flux increases. In the other limit, if the waves are propagating perpendicular to the shoreline, or if the wave crests are perpendicular to the shoreline, rather, then their momentum and energy isn't propagating toward the shore at all. And again, there'd be nothing happening on the shoreline. Longshore transport is zero. As that relative angle comes down from that limit, sediment transport goes up. Somewhere in between, these two limitations are equally unimportant, and we have a maximum. And turns out that maximum is somewhere around 45 degrees, but really hard to know which of the many possible semi-empirical relationships to none of them, certainly none of them are just right. So this is quantitatively a grain of salt, but qualitatively, there is a one-humped function that looks something like that. And then it turns out that when waves are coming from angles on this side, which we call low-angle waves, they have a really different behavior than when waves are coming from what we call high-angle waves. The low-angle waves is the story I showed you before, where the limitation comes from the longshore momentum. It gives you this pattern of change that would tend to diffuse the coastline, tend to smooth out bumps in the coastline. And in that case, we can, for subtle bumps, we can actually treat it as a diffusion problem. Use the diffusion, where we're diffusing coastline shape, use a diffusion equation, and analytically treat its evolution. But when waves come from angles that are greater than the one that maximizes the longshore sediment flux, you get the opposite pattern here, because now the limitation comes from how the rate of momentum is being transported toward the shore. So the flux of momentum toward the shore here is greater than it is over here, just because of this relative angle. And in this case, this is the pattern of fluxes. So now we've got convex areas are going to be accreting and concave areas eroding. That's going to lead to the exaggeration of whatever topography you start, any whatever shape of the coastline you start with, which leads to questions of what's going to happen. So you can talk about this in terms of an instability. If you have any infinitesimal perturbations, they're going to grow. As they grow, something else is going to happen, as always happens in these kinds of problems. As you reach a finite amplitude, the approximations that we need to do analytically aren't valid anymore. There's going to be some kind of finite amplitude evolution, interactions between different growing features of some sort. And to address those, you need a numerical model. So a bunch of years back, we made a simple numerical model that just includes these dynamics I've been talking about. Wave shadow gradients treated fairly simply. This is a semi-empirical relationship for longshore flux that everybody knows is not right, but a lot of people use, and there's none of them that are just right, so it's as good as any. This is just the conservation of nearshore mass, and there's, I won't talk much about this, this new model that does some things, treats the details of the wave shadow gradients a little better, and well, the results I'm going to show you come just from this coastline evolution model. To start with, if the wave climate is symmetric or close to symmetric, where I mean the influence of waves on a longshore transport from left and right looking offshore are equal or not too far from equal, then we get these cape-like features that grow in scale over time. And if things work well here, we get to show a fun movie.
B to project only there and not here.
No, I see a button I can push. There we go. Could you do me a favor and push the next button when I get there? So we see that the shape of these features, after they first evolved, doesn't change over time, but their scale does, because we're losing them over time. And that's because of wave shadow effects. Once one of these is smaller than its neighbors, it's missing some of these higher angle wave influences, and eventually the local wave climate there is dominated by low angle waves, and it gets smoothed out. And then we have fewer of them remaining, and they're bigger. These colors just show when the coastline was generated. This is graphics that go back to Andreessen's time in my lab. Let's go to the next page. Thank you. This is what you get if you've got an asymmetric distribution of waves, so much more influence from the left than the right, and a fair dominance of the high angle waves over the low angle waves. If you're dominated by low angle waves, by the way, it just stays flat, and I wouldn't show you that movie. But that's how flying spits come about, and a couple of other, or a range of other coastline shapes and behaviors emerge out of these really simple interactions as well. And some work also involving Andrew more recently has looked at the development of spits and these convex coastline bits that we tend to get off headlands like Cape Cod. So the point for us here is that the interactions in this modeling approach are inherently large scale in two senses. One is that the details of what's going on at the smaller scales don't affect them. Not only the patterns of bars and channels that have smaller space and time scales, we at least maybe implicitly assume that they don't affect any of this, but really we could be talking about a world where the beach was made of croquet balls floating in glycerin or being transported by glycerin. The details at the smaller scale don't affect the distributions of momentum fluxes as a function of coastline orientation that's driving all of this. If we just calibrated the one rate constant in the transport equation to match croquet balls being moved by glycerin, everything would be identical. Also, I won't show you these details, but using a bunch of LiDAR observations of coastline changes over a bunch of different times, we've shown that these large-scale interactions, well, first of all, they really only matter for an open ocean coastline at scales of a few kilometers and up, or a couple of kilometers and up, but the scales that happen at smaller, the changes that happen at smaller scales, like those shoreline undulations related to the bars that I showed you, those don't add up to anything over time. They just come and go more or less random locations, and it's these curvature-driven influences that we can see having a cumulative effect in the long term. I think compared to a more directly reductionistic approach, whether we started at the scale of bars and channels or ripples or sand grains, the explanations here are clearly more direct. I'll come back to that a little bit. It's kind of like trying to explain water waves. We can understand them more directly and better using pressure and acceleration and inertia than we can trying to model molecular collisions. Also, potentially, this is a safer route to making accurate predictions, or in this context, predictions is the wrong word, it should be forecasts. We don't know what the forcing is going to be like, et cetera, but these predictions for the old explanation of prediction dichotomy in this context, that if we get these interactions right, then we don't have to worry about the potential that errors cascade up from that our grain scale model or our ripple scale model or our bar scale model. Of course, now in, so this is important for some practical circumstances. This is showing a few different scenarios for what happens if you start with that coastline that shares some of the characteristics of the Carolina Capes, but isn't a model of the Carolina Capes in any of the normal senses. And if we take, if we alter the wave climate that generated this coastline in various ways, even fairly subtle changes in the wave climate give us pretty pronounced areas of accentuated erosion in red and accretion in green. And how that pattern change happens depends on just how the climate changes, the wave climate change. This is probably something that's going to become more important going into the future with warming affecting storm statistics, both tropical and extratropical. That's going to affect the statistical distribution of waves from different angles. So this is going to be relevant for human coastline development going into the future. Potentially, this is going to be a better way, arguably, to make such forecasts that are societally useful. However, to do that, we'd really need to get these relationships better nailed down. We need a lot of empirical work to be done to get a better a longshore sediment flux versus wave angle relationship, for example, among other things. This, let's see, won't spend much time on this, but this is just another following on that climate change story. This is what happens in a simulation if we put a wave climate change, we institute a wave climate change that actually ends up corresponding to one that's happened over the last few decades. It's a some buoy measurements off the southeast coast of the US showed a systematic increase in the heights of hurricane generated waves. And if we alter our wave climate in a way consistent with which direction those hurricane generated waves are coming from, we get an increasing asymmetry. So more waves coming from the left tends to make these coastline features themselves become more asymmetric. That corresponds to increasing rates of erosion on the updrift on the left flanks of these capes and decreased rates of erosion on the downdrift side. If we then combine that with a representation of beach nourishment in locations that correspond roughly relative to the shape of the coastline to some of the places that have been nourishing the beaches the longest in the US, right next to that Wrightsville Beach picture I showed you, or the figure eight picture I showed you is Wrightsville Beach. It's been doing beach nourishment since the 60s. And let's see, the black line shows us the cumulative rates of sand volume put on the beach on the flank of Cape Fear that includes Wrightsville Beach. The dotted lines show the model results for how much sand you need, the rates of sand that you need to add in these locations to keep erosion from happening in the long term in the location of these towns. And in effect, in the model, what you have to do is stabilize the whole flank of the cape. You end up nourishing that whole cape flank, even though you think you're just nourishing your own town. And the dotted line here is the model results for how much sand you need to stabilize the location of these towns without the wave climate change. And the circled and dotted lines here are the model results for cumulative nourishment if you do include wave climate change. The point isn't how well they match. That we could tune that with the one adjustable parameter in the model. The point is just that we come closer to matching the observations if we include the wave climate change, which suggests that the wave climate signal, although we can't see it in the morphology of these capes like we can in the other capes, I didn't mention that part, we could see an adjustment that is a tendency toward greater accretion on the updrift flank of undeveloped capes. We can't see it in the morphological change on this cape, but we can see it in the human system apparently. So this is, comes down to increasing rates of resource expenditure, and it's got practical implications, so we might want to get our forecasts quantitatively accurate as well as find better explanations for our own sense of the satisfaction. Okay, so, which kind of takes us toward subjectivity, and one aspect of this is that to some degree we can have our cake and eat it too in a lot of cases here. That if treating emergent scale interactions is the most direct way to explain phenomena on a particular scale, we can often then reductionistically explain where those interactions come from. Like with the water wave example, we can go down to statistical mechanics or even quantum mechanics to explain the molecular dynamics, and we can model a water wave in a way that allows us to both understand how it works and predict how it works nicely, but still feel like we're on this really firm footing as we can explain where those macroscopic interactions come from a smaller level, smaller scale. Just feels better. It doesn't mean that we can predict the waves any better or understand the waves any better directly. It just makes us feel better. And this is something we can't always get to in terms of coastlines. We can't right now because, you know, the sediment transport is just treated as a bulk thing. It's not, we can't directly reduce that in a parallel way to macroscopic fluid dynamics. And then when you get into the effects of vegetation or animals or human decision making, it gets even tougher to make that reductionist step. But the point is, this is done stepwise in the scheme, that we don't go straight to, I should mention that while we can't make this reductionistic explanation in all of these cases, we can at least hope that we might be able to at some point. The ideal gas law was initially just a one of these large-scale rule-based stabs at something that we just made a bunch of measurements and had that relationship. Later, we could explain reductionism, but it's still the same gas law.
That's pretty personal to us here in New England.
Pretty.
You played a football.
Yeah, it works. Okay. So there's still a tendency toward people liking explicit numerical reductionism for fairly good. And when I say explicit numerical reductionism, what I mean is explicitly representing the interactions on a scale as small as possible in a numerical model. And when hydrodynamics are involved, this again is probably a fine approach, especially for modeling something like storm surge. And this doesn't make any of that less useful or valid. It's just that some people prefer a mechanistic explanation too, perhaps. That in the case, if we're just doing hydrodynamics down to the smallest scales we can practically treat, then the best explanation we can make is that, well, all of the phenomena that come out of the model come out because of conservation of mass and momentum, which is good, and to some people that's a good explanation. Some people like to understand, well, it happens because this affects this way, and that feeds back on it that way, and that's perhaps, to some degree, a matter of personal taste. And these don't, to some degree, these separate into applied contexts and theoretical contexts, but not completely. There's plenty of scientific contexts where this kind of modeling is going to give you a nice, accurate, reliable answer, and there's plenty of socially relevant contexts where this kind of modeling might be the more effective way to go. But in the end, this might just be the case where the people that like this kind of explanation and modeling get attracted to modeling those kinds of systems and vice versa. And when people sort of argue about what is the best way to model, well, to some degree, we can answer that through testing models, to some degree. However, the same kinds of tests don't apply to all kinds of models. The models that are designed to maximize insight rather than realism, you wouldn't expect them to be as quantitatively accurate necessarily as the ones that are designed for some applied practical or for some scientific context where you're really trying to maximize quantitative accuracy. So there's subjectivity involved in how we evaluate models, but the main point is that keeping in mind that different models are good for different things and different people like different models for different reasons is at least something we should be aware of, I think. And I'll end with that. Thank you.